This week on Behind the Lens, state regulators order protections against electricity shutoffs amid the pandemic, but will New Orleans ratepayers get the same protections? Schools scramble to lock down their graduation plans for the class of 2020. Environmental advocates cry foul as lawmakers meet in Baton Rouge. We'll hear from Russell Honore and Mary Lee Orr. Also, a lawsuit over plans to use part of Angola to house COVID-positive inmates. And data analyst Jeff Asher explains which numbers he's watching for a sign of relief from coronavirus. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by Community Support. Learn more at thelensnoaa.org/donate. We welcome listeners on our partner radio stations, 90.3 FM WAMF LP and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. Just 4 days after Louisiana's first case of coronavirus was announced in March, the Louisiana Public Service Commission announced an executive order. It temporarily prohibits public utilities from disconnecting service to customers. But the Lens has confirmed that New Orleans customers may not enjoy the same protections. Michael Isaac Stein has that.
So this reporting started last week when the Louisiana Public Service Commission passed a slew of new consumer protections relating to utility service shutoffs and late payments during the coronavirus crisis. And, you know, they've now extended a moratorium on service shutoffs until Louisiana enters what the White House is describing as phase two of the national reopening plan. So phase two, you know, that is described, you know, we'll see bars open again. We'll see large venues opening again, you know, football stadiums opening again, but with certain restrictions. So obviously that's very much not where we are in this current moment. So that's still a little ways off, although, you know, we don't know exactly when. So we were looking at these restrictions and, you know, realizing that some people looking at those restrictions, you know, assumed that it applied to residents of New Orleans as well. And we wanted to clarify that that is not the case. So the Louisiana Public Service Commission, it regulates utilities throughout Louisiana, except in New Orleans. We're kind of a rarity in that we regulate our own local utilities. So, you know, if you live in New Orleans, you know, you don't pay your energy bill to Entergy. You pay it to Entergy New Orleans, which is actually a specific subsidiary of that parent company. Right. So our regulators for Orleans Parish residents is not the Public Service Commission. It is the New Orleans City Council. And while these Louisiana Public Service Commission, you know, consumer protections have come into place, we have not seen any restrictions passed by the city council. They have relied on some assurances and promises from Entergy New Orleans, but they have not passed any new regulations since the coronavirus crisis started. We have that May 31st date. You know, they say they're not going to do any service shutoffs till then. That is really the one firm assurance that we've gotten from Entergy. You know, there have been they've talked about other services being provided to homeowners and renters during this time. But, you know, I spent a week reporting this, trying to track Entergy down. You know, me and Entergy went back and forth as spokesperson, email to email all week. And I still have not been able to clarify if Entergy is actually offering any new services or aid or assistance to their residential customers. They've opened up some relief to commercial customers who will be able to levelize their bill for the first time ever. So basically this is instead of having your monthly bills, you know, jump from month to month, depending, you know, July, you're going to use more air conditioning than in March. It tries to kind of level out those bills throughout the year. But aside from that expansion, they have not been able to point to anything firm that they have set up in reaction to the coronavirus crisis. Now, this is obviously, you know, different from now most of the rest of Louisiana, where utilities, at the very minimum, will not be able to assess late fees until the end of this crisis.
That takes me to reaction to your questions among city council members. What have they to say about their own regulatory role with regard to energy? And will they follow the lead of the Public Service Commission, for instance, in some of these protections during the shutdowns?
Yeah, so I talked briefly to Councilmember Helena Moreno's office. She's the chair of the Utility Committee, and so she basically she's kind of the point person when it comes to regulating Entergy New Orleans. And you know, they put forward the argument that they're going to hold Entergy New Orleans accountable to the things that they're demanding, that these informal, you know, arrangements will be, you know, satisfied. But they didn't really answer the question as to why it wouldn't be easier to hold Entergy accountable if the regulations were in place. And, you know, there were a few other questions that weren't answered. I think, you know, the council's long-term plan here is something that actually advocates had told us about and argued for. But what Moreno's office told us is that they want to set up regulations, permanent regulations, that will automatically kick into gear when the next time there's an emergency order, right? You know, we live in New Orleans. We can expect that we're going to see flooding or a hurricane or, you know, whatever it may be. And basically now the council seems to be interested in setting up regulations that, you know, okay, as soon as there's an emergency order, you know, all service disconnections are stopped. So measures like that. So it seems like they're taking a long-term view, but I didn't see any commitment to passing regulations in the short term.
I was going to ask about any sort of reaction from the advocacy groups, but in particular, I wonder if the sort of measures that have been approved by the State Public Service Commission are palatable to a lot of the local groups that you hear from a lot on the New Orleans scene. I think about groups such as Alliance for Affordable Energy, just for one.
Right. You know, in the very short term, they want New Orleans protections to meet that of the state, because currently our consumer protections are not as stringent or broad or enforceable. So I think that was kind of the first main reaction. I mean, I think there are parts of the state's regulations that advocates would like to see go a little further. I spoke to the chief of staff of one of the commissioners at the Louisiana Public Service Commission. He is suggesting a few amendments to the existing restrictions. One of those would add a 3-month buffer after we enter phase two. So ending service shutoffs, not just till we enter phase two, but then 3 months after that to give people time to, you know, get back to work, to businesses to start up and things like that. Another interesting idea he brought up, for anyone who's opened an account with Entergy before, you might remember that you put down a deposit with them. Now, something that utilities across the country or utility regulators across the country, rather, are kind of fiddling with is the idea of returning all those to customers instead of keeping them in an account.
Okay. The few other issues like utilities offer such a common point of reference for residents, and certainly the case in New Orleans. We're glad you're following it, Michael Isaacstein, for The Lens. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Tom.
In education news, traditional graduation ceremony plans are on hold as statewide stay-at-home orders and social distancing rules remain in effect. Marta Jusen examines how schools are offering alternative arrangements for graduating seniors.
Certainly, traditions are up in the air right now. I think the main issue, we do have crowd restrictions and stay-at-home orders, but the main issue with timing here is the uncertainty about what's going to happen after May 15th, after the governor's order expires. So a lot of schools are doing is they're either doing virtual celebrations, they're doing maybe car parades. They've had to make alternative plans because we obviously can't have large celebrations or large crowds right now.
What are some of the local schools doing in terms of contingency planning here?
Schools have gotten really creative with their celebrations for seniors. They're doing everything from, you know, putting up yard signs to dropping off gifts at their houses. We also have some schools that are going to open later in May. And they're going to follow social distancing guidelines, by allowing one senior in at a time to walk across the stage and accept their diploma. We have one CEO at a charter network that said, you know, that's just such an important rite of passage that, you know, that they couldn't see canceling it. So they've made adjustments to make sure that that can happen.
Marta, meantime, there's been a delay on state graduation data, which is typically released in the spring. What's going on there?
We usually get that data about now. And what has happened is I think schools were obviously so busy with other things and emergency situations that these what they call the data certification process was initially delayed. But then another factor in that is that part of this verification process literally requires submitting documentation from schools. And we all know that, you know, most staff are not in schools right now. So their ability to actually get paper and to be able to do that safely to access these records is compromised. So that the data release has been delayed.
Marta, what's the outlook for the Orleans Parish School Board? When are their next meetings?
They're going to have two meetings next week. There will be a committee of the whole meeting, which is all their committees kind of wrapped together on Tuesday, and then a full board meeting on Thursday. So we're obviously really looking forward to those meetings so we can learn a little bit more about what things are looking like, you know, both especially financially, but also operationally for the school district.
Marta Jusen on Education for the Lens. Marta Jusen, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you.
To Baton Rouge now, where state lawmakers are back in session. At least some of them are. Some legislators have cited concerns about the spread of COVID-19 and are not attending regularly. Meantime, those who are attending have begun work on several bills favored by energy interest, and that has some environmental groups raising alarms. We had a chance Thursday to talk with Mary Lee Orr with the Louisiana Environmental Action Network and Russell Honore with Green Army.
You know, the senior leadership that the governor and many others have said in the amount of time we have left in the legislature, we should focus on things that are required by law, which is to have the budget done by 1 June. And the proposal was to do 18 bills that could possibly be done between now and the end of the session so we could meet the constitutional requirement to have a budget done. Well, once some people in the legislature saw this, they also saw it as an opportunity to open this week, open, you know, 10 days earlier than what the governor had recommended, which is the 15th. They opened on the 4th. And then this week, that same legislature, those committees, put forth bills dealing with significant environmental issues in committee. And everything's got to come out of a committee. And at the committee level is where the citizens get to express their constitutional right by coming in and saying whether they support or the say no to a bill. We had several bills scheduled this week where the main people affected, the people who live in and around the plants. We had an air monitoring bill. We had an early warning bill to notify people. After all those bills were scheduled this week, we had to fight to get them delayed. And then tonight, as we speak, which will start here in a few minutes, they're having a Senate session tonight. Full Senate meeting. After the Senate meeting, which I scheduled to start about 6, they're going to go into committee meeting to hear a bill called SB 359. 359 is designed to take away the parish's ability to sue oil and gas for abandoned oil fields that they have left in the parishes. These suits have been going on for 5 years, waiting to go in the final phase of litigation. And now the legislature, doing the COVID response here, doing an emergency has been called by the governor, encouraging people to stay home, open the legislature early against the recommendations of the governor. And now they are having a bill at night where the people, again, the coastal parishes, the people that we give voice to, the citizens who are concerned about pollution and the Bend of Wells, they're having a committee meeting tonight, Tom. Even I can't go to that meeting. You know why? Because I'm a vulnerable person, my age and certain medical. So I can't go to that meeting tonight. They're having a committee meeting at night. They know the elderly people who are in parish governments along the coast. They probably won't show up. So here we got Lobby and Louisiana Oil and Gas and Mid-Continental Oil, big-time lobbyists in there tonight, pushing this through committee to say, hey, parishes can't sue, only the state can sue. Just the reverse of that, last night this time, the state majority party argued that the governor should not have the authority to keep the shutdown in place, that the parishes should have the authority. So yesterday, the majority in the House decided that the parishes should be in charge and should do what they want when it comes to opening the parishes up. Today, they're in arguing that the parishes shouldn't have a constitutional right to sue to ensure that the companies clean up their mess. I apologize for that long opening. I kicked the rest of this over to Mary Lee to clean up.
I'm laughing because it's not true, sir. You did great.
We turn from the general to the field marshal.
There you go.
I got a promotion, sir.
There you go, field marshal.
Mary Lee Orr, tell me, are you watching these same bills with the same level of concern?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's a group of us, of which the general is part of, writing a letter to the head of the Senate, the head of the House. We'll go to the governor and all the members of the House of Representatives and the members of the Senate. And we're saying that the right of the public to observe and participate in our government is fundamental to our democracy. And what the general talked about is not a democratic process. People cannot stay at home like the governor, even the president has recommended us to do, and attend legislative proceedings. And as the general said, I will back him up. Many of our own members, I can speak for our organization, are in the vulnerable population. African American, older, diabetic, pre-existing conditions that make them more susceptible to the COVID-19. So absolutely, we're watching and we're concerned that used to be, we've kind of felt 30 something years ago, it was like a two-legged process, you know, the big guys had lobbyists and government and the legislators, and there really wasn't a voice for the people. Well, I feel like we're going backwards. There's no way for us to participate. So we are advocating in this letter, the general's part of it, saying only deal with the fundamental bills and then wait until it's safe for the public to participate the way they should in the democratic process. That's what our country is all about. That's all that we're asking for. Certainly put an asterisk on what the general said about the bill. What sort of hypocrisy in a way, right? On one side, you're saying, oh, well, we don't want the parish to have any of these rights. We're going to take them away. And there's nobody there to even help with that. And then the other side, they're saying, well, no, we're going to give them all the authority about something else. So I'm afraid that we're not really doing this under much sunshine. Someone said today it's like in the dead of night or the dark of night. And that's no way to treat our state, the people, the governor, even the legislators themselves. I've spoken myself personally, I'll say this for me, not for the general, to legislators who are personally fearful for themselves to attend the session. And then we bring other people in. It just makes it even more serious for their health.
Yeah. Ted James comes to mind, Representative Ted James, who survived a bout with the coronavirus and was for several days in intensive care at literally death's door among those members who have said they simply cannot attend as frequently as one would expect lawmakers to attend. What would you rather, I mean, if you had to watch this legislative session reconvene as it has, what would you rather this lawmaking body be tackling in terms of legislation?
Well, I think it's just self-explanatory, and I don't know if everybody would want me to go through every bill. The general certainly could probably be more eloquent. But the point is, the key word here is, Tom, essential. We need to do essential business to comply with the law and let the legislators be safe. The public have the right to participate when it's safer for them to do that. That's it. I mean, it's not complicated. This is a pandemic. This is an unprecedented time in our lifetime. We've never experienced anything like this. So we need to be able to have our leadership to be flexible. And I do want to say this, whether you're Democrat or Republican, it doesn't really matter to me. But I think our governor has shown outstanding leadership. He's been a calm presence. He's been reasonable and fair.
What would you rather this group of lawmakers be doing with their time right now, General?
Well, they should be focused on the budget, because we have to have the budget done by 1 June. That's in the Constitution. And also in the Constitution, they have to have a balanced budget. And this is going to be a bitter pill to swill, because they don't have the amount of money they had last year, and they've incurred more expenses, and they're not taking in the amount of tax that they would normally take in. So with retail down and much of our budget is focused on sales tax as opposed to property tax, which is one of the lowest in the nation, or on industrial tax, the only source we have is sales tax.
Certainly you both stay busy in the best of times with environmental advocacy work, and as you alluded to earlier, you're simply not in a position to be able to do a lot of those things, such as go to the legislature, visit with stakeholders in some of the areas of Cancer Alley, for instance. So tell me, General, what are you doing? We certainly see a lot of you on cable TV, but what are you able to do at this point to support your neighbors and others in this this COVID crisis that we're all dealing with?
Well, number one, I stay active on social media with Twitter and Facebook, highlighting things that people inside my network needs to know, and ask them to give voice to the local legislature as well as to the national senators and congressional representative on actions that need to be taken at the national level to make us more effective, being that we need a national strategy for COVID-19. We don't have it. We need a logistical logistic plan for COVID-19. We don't have it. And tomorrow at 1 o'clock, I'll be testifying before the House Oversight Committee in Washington. I'll be doing that virtual. And the purpose of that oversight, it'll be the first oversight committee that will ever be done, an open committee in the Congress. And they're doing a congressional oversight of the COVID response. And I'm told that this will be the first one ever done, where they have a person that normally fly to Washington, go into a congressional hearing room, you sit down, you've seen these things on C-SPAN, the witness make a statement, then for the next hour, you're grilled by both sides on the proposition or the concept. I will do that tomorrow. I will give an opening statement about the absence of a national strategy, the absence of national logistics. I will thank the first line responders, the doctors, nurses, and the last responders who take care of people who've died, and recognize the pain they've gone through. But we really need a well-resourced national strategy to defeat this virus, because we've got to go on the offense, and we cannot go on the offense by just responding. Every day, more and more people die. We're almost up to a point where we got 3,000 people a day die from this COVID virus. And it's getting to be like routine, and people are not paying attention. We got to pay attention to this. We need a national plan that's resourced, that does the test, the tracing, and the contain. We've got to get that done. And that's what I'll be testifying before the House Oversight Committee tomorrow, led by Representative Congressional Lady Bellino from New York, and co-chaired by Mr. Jim Jordan, Congressman from Ohio. And that will be tomorrow afternoon. That's what keeps me busy, engaging with the national media, both television and print, and then dealing, now that the legislature got started, with the state media, as well as posting on Facebook and Twitter to people who monitor my feed, as well as the Green Army feed, making the people aware, asking them to call their legislators to stop this fly-by-night hearings on issues dealing with environmental protection and pollution, having bills rammed through this week like the one tonight that affect the health of our people, the quality of our air and our water and our land. That's what I've been doing. I'll continue to do that. But it's unfortunate I can't do it from a position in the Capitol, along with sometime busload of citizens, because those very citizens who have been the biggest casualties of this COVID attack are the very ones that are fighting for clean air, because the national data show that this particular place, like St. John Parish, one of the highest per capita death rates in America, and the community that it affects are the same people we fight for in the legislation. The purpose of the Green Army is to fight pollution, because we got to protect the people's health. They cannot come to the Capitol. I can't go to the Capitol. So we're making our voice heard as best we can, social media, Twitter and Facebook, and calling the media and making sure they're shining the light of day on what's happening at that Capitol tonight is wrong. It's not democratic, and it's disrespectful to 70% of the people who died in Louisiana, was the last figure I saw, African-Americans, many of them in Cancer Alley, have taken the biggest toll. Those are the very people that we go to the Capitol and argue for clean air and clean water and clean land. That's what LEAN does. That's what we do. We fight for clean air, clean water, clean land, and protect the health of the people. They cannot go to the Capitol. So tonight, we got SB 359 going on, and the very people we need there to say, allow this bill to stand, this law to stand as it is, that allow the parishes to sue, because Big Oil need to clean up their mess.
Everything he said, amen, I echo, and eloquently said.
My thanks to Mary Lee with the Louisiana Environmental Action Network, and of course, the one, the only, Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, U.S. Army retired, founder, Green Army. I thank you both, and stay safe.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for having us, Tom.
After the break, an update on state inmate casualties from the pandemic, and Jeff Asher breaks down local and state data on the impact of the virus here at home. You're listening to Behind the Lens on podcast app, on our website, or on one of our partner radio stations, 102.3 FM WHIV LP and 90.3 FM WAMF LP New Orleans.
I'm Martin Peterson, board chair of the board of directors of The Lens. And I just, I haven't seen any of my esteemed colleagues now in 7 weeks, except for Karen across the sidewalk in front of her house, but I haven't seen the rest. I've only seen them on Slack. And I just want to express my heartfelt appreciation for the work they've been doing in these past 7 weeks. I just know that the lens has really become an essential source. It always was important, and it was always doing work at a high level. But in these 7 weeks during this crisis, it has become an essential source for local news. And it's been a comfort to know that they're on the case. I know that I'm speaking on behalf of the board of directors about how proud we are and appreciative, but I say it as a citizen of New Orleans and of the state of Louisiana. There just is no substitute for the work you're doing right now, and it's very, very important. I am a monthly contributor to the Lens, but I kicked in a little extra for this Giving Tuesday thing, just simply because, you know, like any amount of money that anybody gives, and we have a lot of new people coming to the Lens, literally any amount is appreciated. It's a show of support, whether it's $5 or $500 or $5,000. Whatever folks can give would be greatly appreciated. And certainly, again, I'm honored to be part of this organization, and I'm proud of the work that you're doing. So please support the Lens.
Behind the Lens, a podcast by thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Lawsuit filings have revealed new details about the use of an Angola facility to house coronavirus patients. Nick Krastel has details on that and an update on those state inmates facing the virus.
Yeah, the Department of Corrections just put out updated numbers. They update the number of state prisoners who have tested positive for COVID-19 every day in the morning, and they just put out the new numbers. And they're reporting another death of an inmate at Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. And that's the fourth death from COVID-19 that's happened there. The other one was at the Louisiana Correctional Institute for Women. So now there have been five deaths of state prisoners total. 345 prisoners have tested positive for the disease. And so far, aside from one portion of the Louisiana Correctional Institute for Women, they have not been doing mass testing. So those the majority of those 345 positive tests are people who are showing symptoms of the disease.
With that in mind, you've been doing some reporting this week on a particular part of Angola, Camp J. Remind people what Camp J is.
Camp J is a camp at Angola, at Louisiana State Penitentiary, that had been shut down in 2018. It was formerly used as a restrictive housing unit, so a disciplinary housing unit for people who had rules infractions within the prison, were housed there and held in solitary confinement. And kind of by all accounts was this pretty bad place to be. So it was shut down in 2018. But now the Department of Corrections has decided to use it as a place to house people who have tested positive for coronavirus in local jails throughout the state. So they are working with local sheriffs and local jails to transport prisoners who have tested positive for coronavirus. Many of them who are still pretrial have not been convicted of a crime yet, to Camp J, in order to be held there until they have recovered from the virus. So the lawsuit was filed by the Promise of Justice Initiative and the Southern Poverty Law Center. And they, first of all, they're trying to get these transfers stopped and trying to stop the DOC's plan to hold prisoners at Camp J. They allege that it's bad for a number of reasons. One being that the prisoners are being moved to far away from a hospital. The nearest hospital is in West Feliciana Parish, but that hospital doesn't have any ventilators. So prisoners have, when they've needed to go to the hospital, have been driven to Baton Rouge, which is over an hour away. And then they also have concerns that by transporting coronavirus positive inmates to Angola, that they are then potentially exposing the rest of the prisoner population at the prison to coronavirus. Those are kind of the two main concerns. The lawsuit was filed earlier this month, and there wasn't quite as much information about what the conditions at Camp J were actually like. Some of that is being revealed now.
The DOC, sorry, the Corrections Department says they're handling these inmates according to CDC guidance, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance. And you have gotten some detail, as you mentioned, as far as the process for handling these inmates. Talk about that for a minute. Walk us through that process, please.
Yeah. So according to the DOC, what happens is when an inmate is brought to Camp J, they're held in a dormitory style setting with about 40 to 50 other prisoners who have tested positive for the disease. And so they're sleeping in bunk beds, beds all in the same room. The DOC has said that they've separated out the bunk beds to be 6 feet from one another. But they're not being housed in individual cells, to start with.
They're basically on the beds or around the beds in a common area.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's a big common space. That's known as cohorting. The CDC has advised against it. They basically say that it's a last option that COVID positive people be held all together in one area. So that's another element of the lawsuit is that the plaintiffs are arguing that's unacceptable and that these prisoners need to be spaced from further apart from one another in isolated cells. So they're held in these dormitory style area for 7 days. And then if their symptoms are beginning to improve, then they are moved to a cell block and they're held in a individual cell for another 7 days. And after that, they are then tested again for the disease, tested twice, actually. And if they test negative both times, then they are transferred back to the facility in which they came from.
What are the alternatives in the viewpoint of the plaintiffs, as they've expressed in their filings? I mean, to send them back to the locals?
Yeah. So what the plaintiffs argue is that, one, the DOC should be working with local jails to figure out solutions on how to isolate inmates in those facilities and not transfer them. That the Department of Corrections, instead of moving all these inmates from around the state and bringing them to this one place, should just instead be working with the local jails to figure out solutions there. And then they also suggest that the DOC use the convention center in New Orleans, the medical monitoring center station, I believe, that was set up for overflow of hospitals for patients to be sent there. Currently, there are many open beds, hundreds of open beds in that facility. And in addition, it has been staffed by at least some portion of probation and parole officers, as well as Louisiana State Police. So the plaintiffs have argued that would be an alternative option for sending these inmates to a place that would be they would receive better care and would be closer to a hospital.
We'll leave it there for now, Nick. Thank you for some important reporting on the COVID crisis in our prison populations. Nick Crastle for The Lens. Thank you, Nick.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom.
As we've watched this pandemic unfold since the very first cases reported overseas, we've made ample use of public data on COVID-19 spread. We wanted to do a little data diving in this episode, so we called up Jeff Asher. The New Orleans native is a widely acclaimed analyst and founder of AH Datalytics. He's done work with such news organizations as 538.com and the New York Times.
Well, for the most part, I rely on the Department of Health dashboard, which has most, or I guess all of the data really that you would need statewide, or almost all of the data that you would need statewide to evaluate where we're at. Obviously, we've got the cases data, we've got death data, they've got testing data, they've got hospitalization and vents data. They've started to do recovery data, but reporting is sort of haphazard. So it's not, I don't entirely know what to make of that. And we can break things down by parish. The testing data, you can break it down by the date the test was administered, sort of. You can break down deaths by the day they were reported versus the day they occurred. So all sorts of information. They've also got a map of census tracts, although that's a little less useful than I think it was initially, because they reported the number of cases per census tract, which was great. And now they've gone back to an actual case count. So they went from a case count, you know, there were 18 cases in this census tract, to giving the a range. So there were, you know, 15 to 30 cases in the census tract, and now they've gone back to giving the actual case count. So that's a positive. So really all sorts of different information on there. The city of New Orleans has its own dashboard. For someone like me and my purposes, it's not particularly useful because it's just the same data that you'd find on the LDH dashboard.
Yeah.
Set on with an Orleans focus. But if you want to just see what things are like just in New Orleans, you don't want to dig through the LDH dashboard, you can look at that. My business partner and I, Ben Horwitz, created a dashboard that's on the city council webpage. And that shows cases in Orleans Parish and in Louisiana. It gives you over time, which is, I think, something that's generally been missing from the LDH dashboard, is a chart of just over time and cases per day. But it's just limited to Louisiana statewide and Orleans Parish. Then if you look, most states have a dashboard of some sort. They vary very highly in terms of the degree of quality. And then there's places like COVIDtracking.com, which if you talk about nationally, they track data. And so if you want to see how many tests or how many cases a state has had over time, you can do that.
I do want to start with the local data and preface this all by saying the governor himself has cited time and time again in his daily media briefings, for instance, the focus on data, the numbers, and where those numbers are coming from, for instance, that really will indicate whether and when the state opens back up in a lot of ways. Clearly, we've been one of the worst hit communities in the nation. A lot of the cases here in New Orleans, in fact, being disproportionately borne by African-American residents, for instance, and other minority groups. Tell me about what sort of trend lines you've been watching here on the city scene since the start of this crisis here.
Well, I mean, obviously we were hit as hard, if not harder, than any place other than maybe New York City, at least at the beginning. And we've obviously had, 463 deaths as of now, with a whole bunch of probable deaths. So
as of Thursday afternoon. Yes, sir.
Yeah, as of Thursday afternoon. So, it seems logical that we'll probably be above 500 at some point. So this is a really big tragedy. for the city of New Orleans. You think about, you compare it to the flu, we average, I think, statewide, like 700 or 800 deaths from the flu or pneumonia each year. So this in under 60 days in New Orleans is just, it's an astronomical tragedy. That's the first thing that, that you sort of take away when you look at our cases over time. Then you look at, if you track cases by when the symptoms of the onset of symptoms occurred, which is the data that the state produces. But really what they're producing is the date of the test minus 4 days on average for the symptoms to be accumulated. So we can really say, we can graph cases over time from when the test was taken. And so if you look at that, really March 29th, March 30th, we had this enormous increase in cases. And 13 or 14 days after the city's initial stay home order on March 16th happened, things began to turn. And so it's one, a tragedy, and two, a weird success story in that New Orleans, as of now, Thursday, May 7th, we've had under 20 new cases in four of the last 5 days. We've had 174 new cases over the last 7 days. So we're really talking about an incredible turnaround. To put that in perspective, in the 7 days leading up to March 18th, we had 172 new cases. So we've basically returned to, with significantly more testing, we returned to the place where we were before our curve got really bad, which isn't to say things can't reverse themselves, but the data definitely shows a very early peak here and then a slow and steady decline over the last 5 weeks or so, 5.5 weeks, which is not necessarily what you see in a lot of places. And I'm just not just talking about in Louisiana, I'm talking nationally. The other thing that you have to do whenever you're talking about New Orleans or locally, you really have to combine New Orleans and Jefferson Parish, especially with testing, because residents of Orleans can go to Jefferson. If you're on the West Bank, you probably want to go to the Jefferson testing site. If you're on the East Bank, you may want to go to the Orleans testing site. So increases in testing in either one of those places can really lead to increases in cases in Orleans, which is why it's good that we're seeing basically the same trend in both Orleans and Jefferson, to us returning largely to where we were before our curve started taking up. But if we lift up our restrictions right now, what's going to happen? We're at a lower base rate. We've got better testing, but is that curve, that exponential growth curve going to return if we lift up? It's really a shot in the dark. That's kind of the trend as we see it right now.
We've heard certainly for weeks and weeks now the phrase of flattening the curve. We're talking about visually on a graph, basically watching the rate of cases, of new cases, and the rates of deaths from COVID-19 declining over time. That would, at least from my layman's perspective, seem to be what we've seen here in New Orleans, at least in recent weeks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I'm not an epidemiologist either. So, talking from my understanding as well, early on, it's doubling every day or doubling every 2 days or every 3 days. And the goal is to make it so that the number of cases are doubling much, much, much more slowly. So that right now, you know, we're talking about doubling every month or every 40 days, which is really effective. I'm just doing the math. It's been 36 days since our cases doubled in Orleans Parish. So we have, you know, more than twice as many cases as we had 36 days ago right now, compared to in March and early April when it was doubling every 3 or 4 days. So that's really what flattening the curve is about, because if you don't do that and you keep on doubling every 4 days or every 5 days, at some point you're going to have hundreds of thousands of people in Orleans Parish sick. And that may, you know, then you're looking at tens of, or thousands or tens of thousands of deaths and an even greater tragedy than we've already seen.
Let's talk for a minute as well about where in Orleans Parish, to begin with, which neighborhoods and which of our residents are really being hit especially hard And that would appear to be the predominantly African-American areas of the city.
Obviously, it's been very much disproportionately impacting African-American neighborhood census tracts, and just African-Americans as a whole make up a significantly higher rate of deaths than they should in Orleans. They make up 73% of all deaths in Orleans. I think it's 57% statewide. So a significant portion of the deaths, far more than what the simple population total would suggest, or the population ratio. Uh-huh. You can go to the census tract map on the LDH site, and it shows it pretty clearly as far as this disparity. New Orleans East has been hit extremely hard. Places like Central City, Holly Grove, Girtown, those areas have been hit really hard, whereas other places, Gentilly's been hit very hard. Other places that if it was just a population density type map, you would expect to see it spread out much more evenly. But it is reflective of a strong correlation between the number of cases and the percentage of residents that are Black in each census tract that the state is producing. And I actually did that graph of, if you chart on the y-axis the cases per 100,000 per 1,000 residents in each census tract, mm-hmm. and the x-axis is the percent that each census tract is African American. There's a really strong correlation, and as the percentage of each census tract that's Black goes up to 75, 80, 90, 100%, the number of cases per 1,000 residents goes up. So as if it's below 25%. In terms of each census tract African-American, you generally would expect under 10 cases per 1,000 residents in Orleans Parish. If it's over 75% African-American, then you're talking about anywhere from 10 to 30 cases per 1,000 residents.
Wow.
And if you do it in Jefferson Parish, it's even more concentrated in African-American census tracts. So many census tracts in Jefferson Parish have below 25% African-American, and almost all of them have below 10 cases per 1,000 residents. A handful have up to 20, whereas there's about 10 or so census tracts that have more than 75% African-American residents. And there you're looking at only one census tract has under 20 cases per 1,000 residents. The others have over 20. Up to 30, 35 cases per 1,000 residents. So it's a really strong correlation between the ratio of African-American residents as a part of the total census tract to the number of cases and the rate of cases. And that tends to bear out in the death data as well, that we see this concentration and this really, unfortunate concentration by race.
Is this something that is more an urban phenomenon as opposed to numbers from more rural parishes in the state, at least that we're seeing at this point?
Yes. As far as I know, obviously Orleans and Jefferson have been the big two. East Baton Rouge has been picking up, Cato Parish. It's been, and I think that's a national trend, that we've seen it most in urban areas, except in a handful of rural areas where there's been like large meatpacking plants or prisons that have been hotspots that are in rural areas. For the most part, it is generally been an urban thing, but that doesn't mean it has to stay that way. We also get significantly more testing in Jefferson and Orleans. They, they're making up maybe 10% of cases, 15% of cases each day, but 20 to 30% of tests done statewide each day happening in Orleans and Jefferson. So the share of tests, if you're going to have a lot of tests in one spot, you're going to have more cases there. So is the fact that we're not testing in rural areas a cause for concern? Absolutely. The other cause for concern being that, Orleans and Jefferson have significantly more hospital capacity. So a surge in cases here may not be as damaging as a surge in cases in a rural area that's a smaller surge, but where they don't have the hospital capacity to be able to take care of that. So it really, it's a lot, that gets to one of the major questions, which is when we start to lift restrictions, if urban areas who got hit harder are better at not lifting restrictions, better at social distancing, better at wearing masks, is this going to become a rural issue next?
Yeah, a question on a lot of people's minds. In fact, regarding that that state data portal at ldh.gov/coronavirus, if I recall, it seems like a very comprehensive source of data from across the state. What's missing in your view from an analyst's perspective? From what's missing from this site?
That's a great question. I mean, I posted on Twitter a couple weeks ago a wish list, and they hit many of these things. The census tract data is fascinating. They've added cases and deaths by race. They haven't broken it down by race and gender, so I think it would be interesting to do that. The other thing is they've got data on testing by date of onset of symptoms and by date of death versus so you don't just have to track by the date that everything is being reported, which is important because Matt Sledge reported yesterday that a sheriff's deputy at OPSO had died, but the death occurred on April 18th and they just reported it on Tuesday. So we have a significant lag in a lot of these deaths. And so understanding what's happening in deaths, we're probably seeing a lot of stuff that happened a couple weeks ago, right, which is having deaths by date of report is important, but we can't break it down by parish. So I would like to know how many cases we had by date of test in Orleans Parish. Can't really see that. We can only see that statewide. If we see a jump in that, are we seeing a jump statewide, or is something happening in East Baton Rouge and Orleans is still going down? So that's an important question going forward, getting that really at the state level. Aside from that, though, I think that the biggest thing that's missing relates to testing. The state has been reporting testing data since March. They've been reporting testing data by parish since, I think, April 1st. So that's great. But on April 24th, they realized that they had 35,000 tests that had been reported that were duplicates. So these are all negative tests where one lab reported them and another lab reported it. For whatever reason, they had a huge error in terms of the number of overall tests they were reporting. So they fixed that, but they never backdated the test numbers. So we really only have testing data back to April 24th when they started to be more careful about not reporting duplicates. So it would be great if we could get testing data by day that is backdated after all of the duplicates were removed. And that would help us to have a better, more holistic understanding of how many tests we're performing each day. Otherwise, we've got about 2 weeks of data, which is great, but it's not 6 weeks of data.
Jeff, we're going to leave it there. You want to tell people how best to follow your work online?
Yeah, I'm mostly on just Twitter at Crimealytics. I post daily updates until, you know, it becomes unnecessary to do so.
We thank you for your time, Jeff Asher, data analyst. Jeff, thanks again, and keep us posted on your observations.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll do, Tom.
That's the show for this week. Our reporting is always online at thelensnoaa.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind the lens.